The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Try a month in print and online for free. And, for a limited time only, get a free wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger to start today.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Audio Reads. This week we hear from Douglas Murray, Professor Paul Dolan and Andrew Watts. First up is Douglas Murray on what Labour's new attack line should be now that the Tories have become the party of the NHS.
I wonder what the Labour Party will use as its scare slogan at the next election. After all, the usual one of insert number, weeks, days, minutes to save the NHS may not work next time. Not that it worked every time before, but it has long been the favourite attack line of a British left that likes to portray the Conservative Party as so ravenously right-wing that whenever it comes to power, it wastes not a moment in dismantling Attlee's post-war creation. And yet, although the Conservative Party has been in power fairly often since 1945, not once has it managed to dismantle, privatise or otherwise sell off the NHS. Its tendency, rather, has been to increase spending, ring-fence spending and more. If the master plan remained the same, then the party has been uniquely inept at its implementation. And, while believable, it seems more likely that the Conservative Party long ago made its peace with the welfare state and that the Labour Party has acted with a degree of disingenuity at recent general elections. For shame. The reason why the line may particularly not work next time is not just that Matt Hancock will not appear in public without his rainbow badge. Rather, it will be because by 2024 it will have become plain that in 2020 a Conservative government ran up one of the biggest bills in history in order to save the NHS. Not from collapse, but from the indignities and worse that so visibly affected parts of the Italian health service at the beginning of the COVID pandemic. Three things at least have become plain over recent weeks. The first is that if the decision to go into this lockdown was taken in order to avert Italian-like scenes in our hospitals, then that has been achieved. Thanks to the success of the lockdown, the Nightingale hospitals have joined the UK workforce in furlough. The second thing that has become plain is that the virus is both worse than some people on the right spent the early part of the crisis pretending, and at the same time, not as bad as we first feared. There is no point in being blasé about this, but this fact can be noted in at least two ways. That the mortality figures do not reach the extreme ends of the earliest projections, whatever the containment policies of the country in question, and that people who have got the virus have been pulling through it, even without hospitalisation, better than was feared at the outset. Which brings me to the third thing that has now become clear. That is the vast cost of this ducking exercise. With almost half the workforce now effectively in the employ of the state, World War II-sized bill for tackling virus was just one of the headlines that went wafting by last week. Yet the point of running up this amount of debt in the 1940s was not just that the threat was existential, but that we did not expect such expenditure of blood and treasure to be demanded again. Can anyone say the same with the virus? China has gifted the world at least three such gifts in the past decade or so. Must we run up a World War II-sized debt every time China infects us? The meeting place of the declining medical threat and the increasing economic threat points to one inexorable fact, which is that this state of suspended animation and consequences cannot go on. If the virus is not as bad as the bods at Imperial College first expected, that it cannot justify the ongoing containment of the population, at least not all of it. It is true that the virus seems to have plenty of anomalies we still don't understand, but while the elderly and those with underlying health conditions do seem to be at risk, the young and healthy do not. And while the vulnerable must continue to be protected, what is not sustainable is for a workforce at almost zero risk to be kept in its rented accommodation and further immiserated due to it. I can already see the books they will write, these millennials and younger. The Boomers' Last Act, they will call it. A generation they were already accusing of having accumulated all the wealth will be said, as their last act, to have forced the majority of the younger population not just into poverty, but into chastity, in order to keep a tiny section of the Boomer Party going a little while longer. A future Margaret Atwood will have a great time collecting royalties of this. As with our current Margaret Atwood, I'm not certain it's as straightforward as that. What I do know is that a way out of the current predicament becomes an economic necessity long before our world becomes risk-free. It will start with those people willing to take the small risk of returning to work. And while the poorer will most likely be forced into taking more risks, I expect that, as things drag on, more and more people are going to accept that just as there are many elements of risk in our lives, so COVID is one of them. If not, then it seems as though we are in one of those moments of history where what you took to be the main event turns out to be the prelude. This tussle is going on in all of us at present, but as the health risks become clearer, so do the economic ones. And while we have a considerable chance of ducking the first, no one has any chance of ducking the second. We have given the health service an awful lot throughout its history, never more than in this year. But the NHS exists to serve the public. The public does not exist solely to serve the NHS. We never did face the threat to the health service that the Labour left pretended. But from small business owners all the way up to government workers, we do now face its counterforce. X number of days to save the economy. Were I a wily new Labour leader, I think I might get working on that line and deploy it against the Conservative Party whenever we're next allowed out to vote.
That was Douglas Murray. And now Professor Paul Dolan, a behavioural scientist at the LSE, on what would have happened if coronavirus started in Sweden instead.
Schools might never have closed in the first place had the coronavirus not started in China. Imagine it had started in Sweden. Whoever responded first was going to set the tone for the nations that followed. When we are uncertain about what to do, we look to the behaviour of others to guide us. Imagine walking down a street with a new restaurant on either side. You remember restaurants, right? And that you do not know anything about either of them. One has some customers inside, the other has none. Assuming you can get a table, you would choose the one with the people in it because in the absence of any prior knowledge about the restaurants, other people provide you with a signal about which to eat in. But imagine that the first person walking down the street had no idea which one to choose and did so based on a spurious reason, such as preferring a red door to a yellow one. The restaurant with the red door would get all the customers, while the one with the yellow door would get none. And this would provide no information at all about which restaurant is better. Now consider China's response to COVID-19, which was to lock down Wuhan. It chose the red door of virus suppression and school closures over the yellow door of mitigation and leaving schools open, with the eventual result of herd immunity. It might have done this for spurious reasons, so far as mitigating impacts are concerned, for example, because it felt bad about being responsible for the virus. But just as people follow others into a restaurant, most countries follow China's lead. Now, there were, of course, epidemiologists who advised suppression because it was expected to result in fewer deaths from COVID-19. And so it has a more rational and substantive basis to it than choosing a restaurant simply because of a preference for a red door over a yellow one. But the advice has so far failed to properly account for indirect deaths from the policy and the wider economic and social impacts, such as that on children and the widening inequalities caused by school closures. To decide which restaurant to go to, you would like advice from experts who, analogous to epidemiologists in a pandemic, know about the calorie content of the food, but you would also like to know many other things too, such as what the food tastes like, how many items are on the menu, and the price of the meal. Once short-term deaths from COVID-19 become the yardstick by which policies are judged, it takes courage to stand out, even if you know you are right, let alone when you can't possibly know for sure what to do. In a world of uncertainty, it is so much easier to follow the herd and risk being one of many who are wrong than it is to stand out and risk being the only one who is wrong. For that reason alone, Anders Tegnell, the epidemiologist advising the Swedish government, is to be commended. It is important to note that Sweden, with its low population density, high number of single-person households, and high trust in government, does lend itself to voluntary social distancing. And so enforced social distancing might still have been the best outcome for short and long-term welfare in many countries. But even so, if COVID-19 had started in Sweden and the country hadn't felt under any pressure to suppress the virus, and if Tegnell had set the tone for how best to respond, it is reasonable to suppose that many more schools would have remained open elsewhere. Elsewhere, but not everywhere. Suppression policies are generally preferred to mitigation ones because they deal more directly with people's fear of the virus, and, relatedly, because they signal that we care about the immediate threat to human life. Mitigation policies address the fear of infection more weakly and lack the power of a virtue signal. Suppression policies might still be more effective, of course, but not for these reasons. When the UK went into lockdown, the public were more than ready for it. In fact, many were clamouring for it on the basis that Italy, Spain, France and Ireland have shown how much they care about the immediate mortality risks by imposing quite stringent restrictions on personal freedoms. The UK government was not signalling hard enough that it cared about people dying, and so when the lockdown finally came, most of the discussion was around whether the measures were stringent enough rather than too stringent. In this sense, the UK government initially chose the restaurant with no one in it, but then ran across the street to the one where most of its public were seated. Anyone brave enough to stand against the herd, the fear factor and the virtue signalling to suggest that closing the schools might be a disproportionate response was considered akin to a genocidal maniac. And so we find ourselves where we are now. Schools are closed and the fear of opening them again looms disproportionately large in many people's minds. It's time for the government and the teaching unions to see past herds, fears and virtue to focus directly on the costs and benefits to the whole of society from its decisions. Based on the balance of evidence from the full range of experts and accounting for lifetime inequalities, the schools should reopen with a phased return on the 1st of June because the benefits to children, particularly disadvantaged ones, outweigh the small increase in mortality risks for predominantly older people that will result. Measures must be put in place to ensure they remain open. This would include properly engaging with and mitigating people's fears and their desire to virtue signal, as well as more practical considerations such as social distancing measures and the appropriate use of PPE.
That was Professor Paul Dolan. And last, Andrew Watts, on why Brits eat so little fish.
Last week's Brexit negotiations, conducted by video conference, failed to come to an agreement on fisheries. Michel Barnier, the EU negotiator and former French fisheries minister, insisted that continued European access to British territorial waters was a prerequisite of any deal. And David Frost, his British counterpart, replied that this was incompatible with our status as an independent coastal state. If there is going to be no deal as a result of fishing, as seems increasingly probable, we are going to have a lot more fish to eat, but we're also going to have to eat a lot more fish. For an island surrounded by fish, Britain has never really been keen on seafood. Never. An analysis of skeletons from a Pictish burial ground in Scotland, published a couple of weeks ago, showed that the Picts ate beef and pork, but no fish, despite living in what is now the fishing village of Port Mahomack. They were quite capable of sailing. There are archaeological remains of a Pictish naval base at Birkhead, on the other side of the Moray Firth. but it seems it just never occurred to them to catch and eat fish. And it is still true. We don't eat as much fish as most Europeans. Food historians suggest that this dates from the Reformation, when rules about fasting were overturned and fish was stigmatised as popish flesh. But the Protestant north of Germany has traditionally eaten more fish than the Catholic south. In Germany, as for most of Europe, the closer you are to the sea, the more fish you eat. Yet we eat roughly the same amount of fish per capita as Austria. There is a butcher in my Cornish fishing village which only survives because of fishermen. Skippers bound to sea for a week will come in and buy £150 worth of steak for their crew. "Do you never eat the fish you catch?" I ask one. "Only if the meat runs out," he says, looking horrified. My own theory is that it's the English language to blame. We can eat beef and pork and, on some level, pretend it's nothing to do with cows and pigs. With fish, you don't have that almost plausible deniability. A John Dory on your plate is always the same as a John Dory in the sea. And for that matter, little Johnny Dory in a Julia Donaldson book that I used to read to my son, and which put us both off the fish for life. We can only seem to eat fish when it's called fish. In fish and chips, or fish pie, or fish fingers. That is, when it's not recognisable as a fish. In the fish markets of Spain or France, you will see nothing but whole fish for sale. But here in the UK, filleting is left to the professionals. Indeed, the Church of England last year launched a campaign to outlaw pointed kitchen knives as a dangerous anachronism, backed by judges and trauma doctors. I read the report and thought, those are men who've never had to fillet a mackerel. In supermarkets, you can buy fish pie mix, a collection of odd bits of skinless, boneless, nameless fish, removing the need for any knife at all, and taking us one further remove from the reality of what we are eating. And reality is, I think, one of the reasons we are so scared of fish. We can judge beef and pork by the colour of the meat. One of the best ways to check if a fish is fresh is to look at its eyes. I'd find it hard to eat bacon if I'd gazed into the pig's eyes first. Harder, anyway. Even when it's cooked, provided it's not coated with batter or breadcrumbs, it's obvious that it's a real animal you're eating. And people in Europe seem better able to cope with this reality. Perhaps because of the language. Perhaps because they didn't have an industrial revolution that took them away from the land as early as we did. I'm not suggesting we should become totally European and, like the Swedes, eat surströmming, the fermented herring that smells so bad that tins have to be opened underwater. Or, like the Sicilians, scoop out the gonads of a sea urchin with a spoon. We do not need the piles of fruits de mer of French fish markets that so fascinate English children on holiday. Or to follow Latvia and Portugal and have a surfeit of lampreys in our supermarkets. But it's hard to understand why we import cod from Iceland and export most of our hake to Spain, when hake is a far superior fish and plentiful in British waters. If you haven't already, you should try it. We've got a lot to get through.
And that was Andrew Watts. Thanks for listening to this episode of Audio Reads. And thanks to all of you who emailed in to give us your thoughts. That is very much appreciated and all of them are read. Do rate and review Spectator Radio and recommend us to your friends and family. See you again next week.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Try a month in print and online for free. And, for a limited time only, get a free wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger to start today.